somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech, by Jakub Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Frit Ord, and the Politiken Foundation.
Episode 19. Expert Opinion with Professor Stephen Nadler. Baruch or Benedict de Spinoza was born in Amsterdam in 1632. While his given name means blessing in both Hebrew and Latin, Spinoza's political theological treatise from 1670 was condemned as a book forged in hell, and Spinoza as a dangerous heretic or atheist by religious and secular rulers and much of public opinion. Spinoza's crime consisted in systematically eroding the foundation of revealed religion and the authority of the Bible. But in addition to his materialist philosophy, Spinoza also championed freedom of thought and expression as a precondition for social peace in a free democratic state. According to Spinoza, the most tyrannical governments are those which make crimes of opinions, for everyone has an inalienable right over his thoughts. And therefore, in a free state, every man may think what he likes and say what he thinks. These were radical ideas in early modern Europe, and too much to stomach for even the tolerant Dutch. With me to explore Spinoza's ideas of freedom of thought and expression, and just where Spinoza drew the red line, is Stephen Nadler, who is the William H. A. II Professor of Philosophy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Professor Nadler is also the author of many books, including Spinoza a Life and A Book Forged in Hell, Spinoza's Scandalous Treatise and the Birth of the Secular Age. Professor Nadler, thank you very much for coming on the podcast. It's a great honor to have you on the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Before we get into the question of Spinoza's view on freedom of thought and expression, I want to try and set the scene, because Spinoza lived and wrote in the Dutch Republic, which was at the cutting edge of European tolerance and free thinking at the time. It was where René Descartes, Pierre Bayle, and John Locke sought refuge. I think Locke's Letter on Toleration was written in the Dutch Republic. So in order to understand the context of Spinoza's ideas, could you very briefly give us sort of a super short executive summary on why and how the Netherlands became a haven for free thinking and religious tolerance?
Well, it's true that the Dutch Republic was more tolerant and indeed more cosmopolitan and in some ways more liberal than most other societies or states in the early modern period. At the same time, though, we don't want to overstate it. There were rather intolerant streams within the Dutch political and religious culture. And so while one could, with the right precautions, write or proclaim or publish things that couldn't possibly get done elsewhere, there were limits. And especially the more conservative elements of the Dutch Reformed Church kept a very close eye on what was going on. That said, though, the regents of the province of Holland were especially reluctant to start engaging in censorship of publication, especially before publication. They, when pressed, would often take some sort of pro forma action against a book or something else after it was published when pressed by the Dutch Reformed Church leaders. But for the most part, especially in cities like Amsterdam and The Hague, I think the as long as the political liberals had the upper hand, which they did mainly between 1650 and 1672, they were reluctant to interfere with a political and economic system that seemed to be working quite well. I think they were afraid that censorship and any kind of perception of repression would ultimately harm their pocketbooks. And so I think the thriving economy of the Dutch Golden Age only encouraged this openness to ideas.
Is this the period referred to, I think, as something like true freedom or a perfect freedom in Dutch history?
Yes, that's right. With the untimely death of William II, who was stadtholder in Holland and other major provinces, and he died in 1650. And that is when these provinces decided to do without a stadtholder, who was sort of a central quasi-monarchical figure. And so Johan de Witt, who was the pensionary for the States of Holland, became effectively the political leader of the Republic at large and set a relatively liberal course. But again, he still had to answer to the right flank and make sure that he didn't cross some lines.
I guess going back even further than that, Spinoza refers directly and indirectly to the conflict between remonstrance and counter-remonstrance. Can you also just give us a very brief idea of what that conflict was about and why it might have been relevant to Spinoza's writings?
Yes, the remonstrants were a camp of liberal Dutch Reformed theologians, followers of Jacob Arminius. They're also called Arminians. And they tended toward a more open-minded set of religious and moral policies, and especially on matters of grace. The Arminians or the Remonstrants tended to believe, tended to take a more, I don't want to say Catholic, but a more liberal, a more liberal attitude towards the workings of divine grace, whereas their more conservative opponents, more Orthodox Calvinists, and these are often called the counter-remonstrants, tended to believe in a very strict doctrine of Calvinist predestination. They're called remonstrants because at the Synod of Dort in the 16-teens, they presented their views and requests for reform in a series of remonstrances, which are basically petitions. And the counter-remonstrants came down very hard in 1618. They gained the upper hand of the Dutch Reformed Church. And for quite a while, effectively maneuvered the remonstrants out of positions of ecclesiastic and even political authority. And so up until about 1650 or so, this battle between the remonstrants and the counter-remonstrants, this back and forth between the liberals and the conservatives in the Dutch Reformed Church, really created an unstable atmosphere. And depending upon who had the upper hand at the moment, one had to be careful about matters of especially religious expression.
Okay, so we've established the background that we have a comparatively tolerant atmosphere when it comes to religion, and a cosmopolitan country, Amsterdam especially. And here we have Spinoza, who's of Jewish Portuguese descent, so a member of minority that I guess flourished compared to many other places in Europe. Of course, the Portuguese Jews had been expelled, some of them first from Spain and then from Portugal. But how does Spinoza's origins influence, if at all, on his thinking and writing?
I think they had a very strong influence. Both his personal experience within being raised and then excommunicated from the Amsterdam Portuguese Jewish community, but then also his study of Jewish philosophy. This was indeed a remarkable Jewish community for the time. There was no ghetto. While there were some restrictions on the Jews, both the Portuguese Jews and later the Eastern European Jews, while Amsterdam and other cities did place some restrictions on their lives and especially in their professional and business activities, they were free to live wherever they wanted. They didn't have to wear any marks in their clothing. They could socialize with the Dutch. It really was a remarkably tolerant environment, much more so for Jews than, let's say, for Catholics in some of the Dutch cities. Catholics were seen to be a kind of subversive force by the Dutch Reformed Church, especially in a country that had only recently liberated itself from the Catholic overlords of Spain.
At times, a very bloody conflict.
It was a long and bloody conflict. And so while Catholics really had to struggle more so to hold services in private, Jews were, by the 1650s, around the time of Spinoza's excommunication, were free to practice Judaism openly with very few restraints. It was a remarkably tolerant atmosphere. And I think, you know, Spinoza was not himself a converso, or to use a pejorative term, a Marano. His parents were. They had been forced to convert to Catholicism back in Portugal. But Spinoza himself was born and raised in an open Jewish community, and he was educated in a Jewish school. And this clearly had a great deal of influence upon him, both in a negative and a positive sense. In his later writings, he seems, he is rather quite hostile, both to organized religion in general, but seems to have a special animus against Jewish ceremonial religion. In a positive way, I think it's very difficult to read Spinoza's writings and not see them both as influenced by and in a kind of ongoing dialogue with Jewish philosophical texts, such as works by Maimonides, Gersonides, and others, but also the entire Jewish intellectual and religious tradition. His discussion of miracles, of prophecy, and certainly of Hebrew scripture all reveal a deep understanding of Jewish literature.
But even at this time, before he had committed anything to paper, he must have expressed some pretty unorthodox ideas on religion, because I think in 1656, he is excommunicated from the Jewish community with some pretty strong terms.
Yeah, I would like to say he's excommunicated with great prejudice. We do actually have evidence for thinking that around the time of the cherem, which is the Hebrew term for a ban or an ostracism, around the time of the cherem, there are good reasons for thinking that he was actually expressing the kinds of ideas, heretical ideas from a Jewish perspective, that we find later in his writings. And so from some documents that were found in the Inquisitional archives, documents from 1658, we learn that Spinoza was reportedly saying things like God exists only philosophically, the law, namely that is Jewish or Mosaic law, is not true, and the soul dies with the body. And these are doctrines which I think we can find either explicitly or with some interpretation in his philosophical writings. And so even though the cherem document speaks only of his abominable heresies and monstrous deeds, and so there's a bit of a mystery as to really why was he put under the ban, anybody who's read Spinoza's philosophical treatises, and then in light of these documents from 1658, there's really no mystery as to why he was ostracized by the Jewish community. He was saying things that both the lay leaders of the community and the rabbis really couldn't possibly tolerate, especially in a community that was still trying to reacclimate many of its members to normative Judaism.
Yeah. But maybe we can get into some of the ideas and why they were seen as so dangerous, specifically in the theological political treatise, to explore Spinoza's ideas on religion and philosophy, which were, of course, quite unorthodox. When I read it, I'm no Spinoza scholar or expert, but when I read it, at first he sort of lured me into this feeling of, why all the fuss? Because he seems very pious. And then he starts chopping away at miracles, at prophecy, at orthodoxy, of religious truth, and then basically reduces religious dogma to very little but guides to charity and justice. By the end, you wonder what role is left for God and therefore to organize religion and their dogma at all.
So I think that while there's a good deal of tact in the theological political treatise, I don't think it's very subtle in the sense that he's that there's an esoteric message, as some Straussians have argued. You know, you read that book and you think, oh my gosh, it's so astoundingly bold. What could the esoteric message possibly be? It's perfectly clear what he has to say about prophecy, about miracles, and about the origins and the interpretation of the Hebrew Bible. The prophets, he says, are simply individuals with especially vivid imaginations. They're gifted storytellers and also individuals of superb moral character. And so the stories they tell are especially good at morally edifying readers. And so for those individuals who are not philosophically well endowed, but nonetheless need to find ways to live a life of virtue, the best way to do that is for them to be inspired by the stories of the prophets. And these are stories in which justice and charity are the overriding message. Miracles in the theological political treatise, and you get the sense that this is one of those topics on which there's a great deal of consistency between the theological political treatise and Spinoza's Ethics, which was not published in his lifetime. David Hume argued that we are never truly justified in believing that a miracle has occurred because the evidence against a miracle is always going to be greater. The probability is always going to be greater than the probability in favor of the miracle. So we're never warranted in believing that a miracle has occurred, where a miracle is defined as a supernaturally caused event that's a violation of the laws of nature. Spinoza went much further than that. He said miracles are metaphysically impossible. They simply cannot happen because there is no such thing as a supernatural providential being who could step in and suspend the laws of nature and create or produce an event that is a violation of nature's laws. And that's because all there is for Spinoza is nature. He'll call it God and refer to God or nature. But there is no supernatural. There is no divine providence. And everything that happens in and through the laws of nature with an absolute necessity. And so if that's all there is, nature cannot violate its own order. And so miracles are metaphysically impossible. Everything happens in nature, through nature's principles, through natural causes, with necessity.
So is it right to say that he basically separates philosophy and theology?
Yes. I've always been puzzled by that in a way. If by theology you mean what beliefs about God and human beings and their relationship, what beliefs are essential for one to obey the divine law? And this is how Spinoza defines theology in the Theological Political Treatise. It's correct. There's a philosophy is about truth, discovering the truth, and theology is about discovering beliefs that are essential for obedience. The reason why I'm often puzzled by the claim, though, is that because if you read Spinoza's Ethics, much of part one of the Ethics, where he discusses the metaphysical principles of the cosmos, is about God. And it offers what he takes to be a philosophically true account of God. So if by theology you mean true principles about the nature of God, then in a way Spinoza does think of philosophy and theology as engaged in the same enterprise. But it's strictly speaking, for him, theology is a matter of discovering just that set of beliefs that are essential to lead one to obey the divine law, where the divine law is simply treat other human beings with justice and charity.
That might not have gone down well with everyone at the time.
I don't think so.
We'll get back to how contemporary society reacted to him. Of course, central for this episode and the podcast is the Spinoza's argument for freedom of thought and expression. And what I found very interesting was that he seems to believe that these values, freedom of thought and expression, are necessary for people of different beliefs to live together and ensure the social peace. The subtitle of the Theological Political Treatise is showing that piety and civil peace are not harmed by allowing freedom of thought, but are destroyed by the abolition of freedom of thought. Now, in many ways, this seems to be wildly at odds with prevailing thought around Europe and also in colonial America. I mean, in colonial America, even the tolerant colonies had very strict laws on what you could say about religious doctrines and those from other sects, because they feared that would disturb the social peace. So why does Spinoza think that freedom of thought and expression are essential for social peace?
Partly it's a matter of the sheer impossibility of truly controlling people's thought and ideas. He thinks that just as a matter of psychological fact, you cannot... you can tell people what you want them to believe, but you can't make them believe anything, especially given Spinoza's view of how ideas in the mind work. You can try to repress beliefs, but that's only going to lead to greater resistance. So just as a practical matter, any attempt by political or ecclesiastic authorities to control what people believe is not just doomed to failure, but will lead to a backlash and civil strife. On the positive side, and here I think in some ways Spinoza anticipates what John Stuart Mill will say several centuries later, that the freedom to philosophize is essential to the discovery of truth. And certainly the discovery of truth is a beneficial thing for society, especially if you want the laws of society to promote virtue, to promote peace and stability in a republic. And so rather than trying to stifle philosophical inquiry for the advancement of science and the arts and social and political well-being, the investigation to truth should be allowed to go unfettered.
Correct me if I'm mistaken, but there are, as I think, at least two camps when it comes to sort of understanding Spinoza's justifications for free speech. One is perhaps sees him maybe as an early champion of liberal ideals. You may be alluding as much by invoking John Stuart Mill. Others justify him or see him as advancing more of a republican ideal, where he's more concerned about the stability and peace of the republic rather than the individual. Is there a clash between these two ideals as you see it, or is it a bit of both?
I don't really see a clash. I mean, I can see how one might think there's a clash. Part of the problem is terms like liberal, conservative, Republican, Democrat, and so on. They're difficult to apply to Spinoza just because I think of the rich depth of his and the variety within his views. If there's a single theme that runs throughout all of Spinoza's writings, it's freedom. You could say that the ethics is devoted to the freedom of the individual. How can a person in a world governed by nature's determinism, is there a way for an individual person to achieve any kind of freedom, where freedom is understood as autonomy, self-determination, and virtue? The Theological Political Treatise is also about freedom, but here it's freedom in the civic setting. What are the freedoms of the citizen, and to what extent can citizens be given freedom consistent with the well-being of the state? And ideally for Spinoza, the state benefits the most when it grants its citizens the highest degree of civic freedom, and individuals benefit the most when they are allowed to pursue philosophy and come as close as possible to the condition of being free individuals. And so I think the freedom at the individual level and freedom at the civic and political level go hand in hand.
So it's both sort of a moral and a utilitarian justifications that matter for Spinoza?
Yes, I agree. And they're mutually supportive. The problem is that most people, as Spinoza at the same time, I don't think he has a great deal of admiration or trust for the masses. And so most people are not going to lead lives of philosophical virtue. And so it may be in the best interest, and this is sort of the more the Republican side of Spinoza than the classically liberal one. The job of the state is to foster, it's not to create this open arena where ideas have free reign. I mean, I think ideally that would be the state's role. But at the same time, the state wants to foster republican virtues in its citizens. And here I think Spinoza was influenced by contemporary Dutch republican thought. And so the state has its own conception of the good life. And without repressing ideas, will strive to create the conditions for people to achieve this kind of virtue.
At this point in time, there have been several authors arguing for religious toleration, and some of them even for universal toleration, including Baptists like Richard Merton and Puritan like Roger Williams. But Spinoza not only argues for tolerance, he argues in favor of free speech on political issues, including the right to criticize policies, at a time where if you went to England, you had very broad seditious libel laws that punished any political dissent with penalties, including whippings. But Spinoza writes, quote, "No one can transfer to another person his natural right or power of reasoning freely and of forming his own opinions on any topic, so no one can be compelled to do this. This is why rule over minds is considered oppressive and why the supreme authority seems to wrong its subjects and to usurp their rights when it tries to prescribe to each person." I would also think that Spinoza's defense of free speech is more robust than John Milton. So far in my research, I can only think of the Levellers, who for a very brief period in the 1640s had similar radical ideas as Spinoza on free speech. So should we see Spinoza as the first sort of articulate defender of a more sophisticated doctrine of political free speech?
Yes, although notice that the passage that you just quoted from is about freedom of belief, not freedom of expression. Attempts to impose beliefs on people will always end up badly. And he actually cites the controversy between the Remonstrants and the Counter-Remonstrants and how that was being stirred up by politicians. He says it degenerated into a schism. And many examples made it manifest that laws passed to settle religious controversies aggravate people more than they correct them, and just leads to a greater schism in society. Now, it is true that I agree with you that Spinoza goes farther in terms of toleration, especially toleration of religion and irreligion, and toleration of speech than anybody else. Even John Locke, who we think of as a hero of toleration, Locke said, though, that atheists will not be tolerated in this, should not be tolerated in the state, because not believing in God, they have no motivation to be moral, and we can't allow these sorts of people. I think that's a really unfortunate, condition for Locke to set on toleration, and that's not something Spinoza would allow. The theological political treatise, towards the end, he ends with this remarkable statement where he says everyone should be granted the right to think what he wants and to say what he thinks. And that looks like a statement of absolute freedom of expression. However, even Spinoza has his limits. He does make an exception for speech that is seditious, that is speech or publications or any sort of public expression that would tend to undermine the authority of the sovereign.
Yes, and that's a very interesting question on where he draws the line. You had a very interesting 2012 piece in the New York Times where you suggest that he tries to distinguish between sort of words and deeds, sort of a classical divide that you often see in debates over free speech. Am I correct in that interpretation?
Yes, although when he says that expressions of ideas that are seditious or that have been deemed to be seditious by the sovereign are not to be allowed, what's ambiguous here is that because he considers such expressions of seditious ideas to be deeds? Or is he saying, well, no, there's more than just deeds that should be suppressed. There's also some expressions of ideas that should be suppressed. I suppose there is a distinction between publishing a pamphlet that impugns the justice and legitimacy of the sovereign versus standing up in a crowd and haranguing them to take action against an unjust sovereign. The latter certainly seems to cross over into the arena of deed. But what about the former? What about publishing a book that questions the legitimacy of Trump's election, for example, because of Russian interference? Is that a deed? Well, not really. It's an expression of ideas. But is that the kind of thing that Spinoza thinks should be repressed? I drew a parallel between something that happened during the Obama administration, where the Attorney General had deemed it illegal for a political advocacy group to engage in any kind of counseling of, I think it was the Kurdish, one of the Kurdish liberation parties, one of the active militant Kurdish parties. This American group was counseling them on how to engage in nonviolent resistance.
It's the Holder versus the Humanitarian Law Project, I think.
Exactly. Yes, that's right. Was it the Kurdish People's Workers' Party?
On the top of my mind, I want to say Sri Lanka, but I'm not.
I think it was the Kurdish party, this seemed to me to be a violation of the First Amendment of the American Constitution, and I ask whether Spinoza likewise would have regarded such. The term is escaping me, where you try to stop the publication of something in advance, prior restraint, as legitimate. I don't see, and who's going to determine what counts as seditious speech and what doesn't? Well, it's going to be the sovereign, presumably. And so that looks like a very dangerous concession to intolerance. And I think there's no good reason in Spinoza for limiting freedom of expression in that way, if indeed that's what it ends up being.
So if Spinoza had been the deciding vote on the Supreme Court, you think he would have found in favor of the Humanitarian Law Project?
Oh, I hate to try to answer that question. I think he would have ruled against Holder. He would have ruled against the Obama administration. Because there's nothing, it would be really hard to make out the case that what the Humanitarian Law Project was engaged in was seditious speech, much less a seditious deed. This is also, I should say, the reason why, we think of the classic liberal state as involving separation of church and state. And some authors writing about Spinoza mistakenly trace back the separation of church and state to Spinoza. I think that's wrong. While Spinoza does argue for extensive religious freedom, What he's talking about there is extensive freedom of religious belief. And people should be free to organize themselves into worship groups as they wish. I think he's perfectly fine with that. What he is concerned with, though, is the organization of public activities under the name of religion, because it is the political or civic sovereign's duty to oversee public welfare, public activities. And when you have a large congregation actively engaged in public activities, then you've entered the sovereign's domain. And there the sovereign does, by Spinoza's principles, have the right to set the rules and limits for those sorts of religious expression.
He also talks about something like a national religion, and only the national religion should be allowed to build sort of imposing places of worship, whereas dissenters should only have the right to build sort of smaller, modest ones. Right. Again, let's try and do something hypothetical and get a little controversial. Say Spinoza was awoken from the dead and teleported into modern-day Amsterdam, and he was taken to sort of a fringe radical mosque that argued in favor of replacing secular Dutch laws with Sharia law. Would Spinoza be in favor of tolerating such a group, or would he say this is where the limits of tolerance and free speech are crossed?
Well, it pains me to say so, but I think given what he seems to say in the theological political treatise, where toleration ends not just at things that are obviously deeds, but at speech, expressions of speech that are seditious, it seems to me that he would be opposed to that type of gathering where it appears to be a plotting to overthrow the secular authorities.
Yeah, that's an interesting hypothetical. In the end of the theological political treatise, Spinoza tries to preempt condemnation and censorship by professing his good faith and willingness to take back any offending passages. But despite this famous Dutch tolerance, Spinoza's writings were not exactly received with enthusiasm by the authorities. His texts were targeted by these anti-Socinian laws that had been adopted in the 1650s, and I believe in 1674, the book was banned outright. And of course, there was a concerted effort to stop the spread of Spinozism. So why did his ideas so shock and outrage the tolerant Dutch?
Well, to say that his ideas are not well received is really the understatement of the year. The backlash was extraordinary, and one critic claimed that the theological political treatise was a book forged in hell by the devil himself. And I think the backlash comes from a number of directions. It was regarded as a politically subversive work because of this emphasis on freedom and the illegitimacy of ecclesiastic or secular authorities to police ideas. But I think the greatest backlash came not from the civic or political, but from the ecclesiastic domain. And a lot of the civil condemnations of the book by the states of Holland and other political bodies came under pressure from leaders of the Reformed consistories. They were taken aback, shocked by the view on miracles, the reduction of prophecy to imagination, and especially the idea that the Bible is just a work of human literature. That's one of the other major themes of the theological political treatise, that the Hebrew Bible is not literally was not literally authored by God, because God is not the kind of anthropomorphic personal being that authors anything, but rather it's a compilation of human writings by numerous authors writing over a long period of time and their different historical and political circumstances for different audiences, all of which are finally put together sometime in the Second Temple period. And that, in fact, the text we have now, through a long process of transmission and copying, is full of errors, it's mutilated, and it's not a source of truth. It doesn't give us truths about God or about the cosmos, about nature. It doesn't give us historical truths. The only truths, the only things that the Bible proclaims that we should take to heart as true are the commands to treat other human beings with justice and charity. That is, the real divine message of Scripture is a very simple moral message. And so this reduction of Scripture to simply a work of human literature, for Spinoza, it's an important tool for undermining the authority of the preaching class in Dutch society. Because in the Netherlands, the preachers who were seeking to control the state and impose their views on the laws and on civil society, one of their most effective tools is the Bible. They can say, "Well, look, we have God's word here, and so we have this kind of authority." And by reducing the Bible to just another work of human literature, particularly imaginative and edifying work, but nonetheless just a work of human literature, Spinoza is trying to undermine this usurpation by ecclesiastics and trying to reduce the sway that they have both in the political arena, but also in people's personal lives. And this, of course, is a slap in the face to the leaders of the Dutch Reformed Church.
But it's also something that could finally unite Protestants and Catholics, because Catholics were not too impressed with Spinoza either, and he ended up on the index, which admittedly was not so difficult.
Right. You could say bravo Spinoza. You did something that nobody else was able to do. You united Catholics and Protestants.
Exactly. But he died in 1677, and his Ethics was published posthumously the same year. Even though there were enormous efforts to try and stop the book, I believe it may have circulated as a manuscript. What was the immediate influence and legacy of Spinoza? I mean, he was so hated, not just by authorities, but also by most commentators and even proponents of religious tolerance thought he was, way beyond the pale.
And yet they couldn't help but read him. It's kind of like a car crash. You don't want to see it, but you can't look away. Jonathan Israel has done some remarkable work on the dissemination of Spinoza's writings. And it seems that despite attempts to suppress them, the works circulated. And Spinoza very quickly was read both by those who opposed him and those who were sympathetic. And I think initially it was just the theological political treatise. But eventually the Ethics itself, a much more difficult and opaque work, was widely discussed. Leibniz, for example, much of Leibniz's philosophy was deeply influenced, both in a positive and negative way, by his reading of the Ethics.
And if we go a bit further into what you mentioned, Jonathan Israel, who, along with Margaret Jacob, has talked about the Radical Enlightenment, what was Spinoza's influence on that strain of thought? I'm thinking people like Diderot, Holbach, and people like this.
I think it was varied. Jonathan has made a really important case for opening up our conception of the Enlightenment. In fact, for thinking not of an Enlightenment, but multiple Enlightenments, both radical and moderate, and not all deriving from the French philosophes. At the same time, I think we shouldn't overstate the case and try to show how all of the Enlightenment, and especially all of the Radical Enlightenment, has its source in Spinoza and Spinozism. I think Spinoza played a very important role. I admire Jonathan's work greatly, but I also think that it's possible to give a little too much credit to Spinoza, both as somebody who inspired Enlightenment thinkers and also inspired opposition in the Enlightenment period. But at the same time, to have ignored Spinoza for so long, I think did him a real injustice.
If we talk about more narrowly his influence on free speech, I mean, typically free speech debates, we talk about, they begin sometimes as late as with John Stuart Mill, but very few invoke Spinoza, at least in my experience. How should we see his influence on freedom of thought and expression?
That's a good question. I think his role has been understated for a long time. And as far as I know, there's practically no mention of Spinoza among the drafters of the United States Constitution. That first generation of American politicians, we know that Jefferson owned some works by Spinoza, but as far as I know, he doesn't cite Spinoza. Locke may have played a greater role there. So, I mean, it's something I'm interested in investigating at some point, what role either explicitly or tacitly Spinoza did play in inspiring the framers of the American Constitution.
Professor Nadler, it has been an absolute privilege to talk to you today. Thank you so much. It's been very enlightening.
It's been my pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for listening. Today's episode was edited by Søren Stehøj. If you like what you heard, why not leave a review on iTunes and share this episode on social media?